Welcome to the Meb Faber Show, where the focus is on helping you grow and preserve your wealth. Join us as we discuss the craft of investing and uncover new and profitable ideas, all to help you grow wealthier and wiser. Better investing starts here.
Meb Faber is the co-founder and chief investment officer at Cambria Investment Management. Due to industry regulations, he will not discuss any of Cambria's funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Cambria Investment Management or its affiliates. For more information, visit CambriaInvestments.com.
Welcome, podcast listeners, to a near end of summer episode, which has me very melancholy. I'm sad about that. I haven't had enough summer yet. I'm actually, by the time you listen to that today, I will be in Colorado. So we got a radio show today. Welcome, Jeff.
Hey, what's happening?
Not much. How's your summer been?
Like you, it's been a little short, which is why you need to be throwing us a Labor Day cookout pretty soon.
Well, you know, the fall time is the best time ever to be in LA. And so I try really hard not to travel, but that's September, October is also always like the heaviest travel months with conferences and things. So listeners, by the way, we'll be in, as I mentioned, I'm in Colorado this week as you're listening to this. So if you're in Colorado and want to say hi, let me know. And then we'll be at various points in the coming months in Nashville, Vegas, San Antonio, and I think Rhode Island. And hopefully, and drag you to do this, as well as hopefully a couple other employees, Wes Gray's March for the Fallen. You laugh as if you haven't walked 28 miles in a long time. Listeners, if you want to come hang out with a whole gaggle of 100 plus and maybe 200 plus quant finance nerds and all of their friends and walk, I think it's 28 miles.
No, come on, man. You're not doing that. There's no way you would keel over.
I've got a marathon in my back pocket. I've got an Olympic triathlon.
Your attempted marathon up in the Rockies years ago was one of the best stories ever.
It's walking. Like, how hard can walking be?
You're out of shape, my friend.
There's two levels where people do it with a 45-pound pack. Anyway, you guys Google it. March for the Fallen, Wes Gray. Sign up. Very likely join. It's the problem for me is that I've never seen Pearl Jam. And they're playing here locally. So I'm going to have to miss that. And so it's conflicted. Anyway.
I guess you don't care for the Fallen that much.
Before we get started with the radio show, big news. We just published our newest book. Can't really claim it's our book. I was just the editor with Jeff's help, where we curated The Best Investment Writing, Volume 2. It's about twice the size as Volume 1. We're really proud of it. It's about 40 curated essays ranging in length from one page to, what's the longest, like 30 pages?
Around there.
And it's pretty awesome. I mean, some of the smartest, best writers in our world. It's a pretty fantastic read. You can pick it up, put it down. It's on Kindle and on Amazon, like 20, 30 bucks or something.
Yep. We'll also be dripping out the bonus episodes.
That's right. On every Monday for the next month or two, you guys will notice we just did our first one. By the time this comes out, two bonus episodes on Mondays, where we've asked some of the authors if they wanted to read their submission, that they could. So you'll hear all sorts of different voices on the podcast. It's a lot of fun. You get little snippets. By the way, all the proceeds go to charity of the author's choice. And I don't think a single charity has ever been named twice in duplicate. And it's a pretty wide spectrum of charities. The best part was last year, only like five people sent in their charities. And I was like, I'm not going to hound you people over email. So these five people got big checks for the entire book that no one else, just because no one else responded. So there's one guy's like local church wrote me like, they're like, oh my God, thank you so much for this. Are you kidding me? I said, well, thank all the other authors because none of them responded. Anyway, it's a really wonderful book. We're proud of it. Take it for a spin. Let us know what you think. Write a review on Amazon. I don't think we have any yet, do we?
I hadn't seen it.
It's a really fun book, and hopefully we'll be doing it for many years to come. Jeff's laughing because he bore a lot of the brunt this year, so you guys send Jeff thank you if you think it's a good book. What are we talking about today?
Let's do our standard where we get into some of your tweets, and then let's tackle some listener Q&A. Let's start with one of your recent articles, though, the one about nobody ever got fired for buying Vanguard. Why don't you just give a quick recap for anybody who's not familiar with it, and then Give us the main takeaway.
I was trying to write an article and we took to Twitter to do a poll. And I said, which title do you want? And the first title was something like, are you still investing in dividends seriously? But it was the SRSLY. It's like the acronym for millennials. One was nobody ever got fired for investing with Vanguard. Maybe they should be. And the last one, I forget what it was, something about dividends. But the point of the article was we've done a couple white papers and longtime listeners will have great degree of familiarity with this topic. We've talked about it a number of times. But basically the concept is, look, we love Vanguard. We've mentioned many times, think Bogle is a national treasure. We think that they've done more to help our investing world than anyone else, any other company. We use Vanguard funds, have more good things to say about them than anyone else. That having been said, and by the way, listen to a great podcast with Bogle. AQR has a new podcast, by the way. I forget what it's called. Curious Investor or something. But they had a good one with Cliff and Jack. Well worth listening to. And by the way, listeners, as we love to get off topic, we have a new feature for the Idea Farm where we send out the top podcasts of the week. I would pay like $10,000 a year for this. Actually, we do because we hired someone to do it. But we send out our top podcasts of the week, investment podcasts. Some weeks they'll be zero. Some weeks they'll probably be five. And any potpourri episodes, but a pretty awesome feature. I wish someone else would have done it, but we're happy to be doing it. Okay, so anyway, Jack and Cliff were talking. So I think Vanguard's fantastic. That even said, not every fund company has all good funds. And then not all good funds are good all the time. And so Vanguard's got all sorts of screwy funds that are not really necessarily on brand. People don't know this. They have hedge fund-like strategies. They had a strategy. I think it's still around. It charges over 1% a year. They have more active mutual funds than passive mutual funds. A lot of people are very surprised about that. But in general, they're pretty awesome. However, we wanted to pick on the dividend space because we've been ranting about this for years where we said, look, a lot of these strategies, focusing on dividends alone is totally nonsensical. It literally makes no sense to focus just on dividends. My caveat was, of course, that if you use a valuation filter and some other screens, then it's reasonable, but it makes no sense just to focus on dividends. And that having been said, if you do focus just on dividends, it gives you a slight value tilt historically. So what you're really getting is a slight tilt towards value in junkier companies. Most people think that high-yielding dividend stocks are higher quality, but on average, they're worse quality. They're of higher leverage, et cetera. So we took a look at some of the top dividend ETFs, and the biggest, of course, is Vanguard's. It's got like $30 billion in assets, VIG. And the problem with that fund, and I think it's based on the NASDAQ Dividend Aristocrats, it's, I think the screening criteria is simply you had to pay a dividend for 15 years in a row or something.
It might be increasing.
Increasing. So Apple's not even... The largest stock in the world isn't even eligible for another decade or something, right? Like that's how nonsensical the strategy is. No valuation filter. So the problem is going back to not every fund complex has good funds. Not every good fund is good all the time. It's already a nonsensical investment strategy. But add on top of that, the fact that you've had this massive search for yield over the past 18 years, and it's pushed all these dividend stocks and dividend yielding funds, high yielders, into very expensive territory. And we've been preaching this for the last couple of years. And they're still expensive. So you guys don't believe me. You can look at our white paper or blog post on this or type your dividend fund into Morningstar and it'll spit out the valuation. And VIG is like the most expensive ETF in the dividend space, like across all the metrics. And it gives you like the same yield as the S&P. So why in God's name would anyone want that? And it's been underperforming by a mile the last couple of years. And we think it will continue to underperform. So obviously we compared it to the other top five dividend ETFs. We compared it to the buyback ETF. We compared it to our shareholder yield fund. Anyway, it was just a interesting comparison to get people out of their comfort zone and think for a little bit. Because the origins of the article, which you had touched upon because you wrote that part of it, was... The phrase goes back to IBM, right? Where it was, no one gets fired for buying IBM, meaning if you buy a product and it's IBM and it doesn't work, well, you can easily blame, hey, it's IBM, it's not my fault. But if you bought some crazy new startup's product and it didn't work, you get fired. If it does work, pat on the back. That's also goes to explain so much in our world of career risk. So if you go buy a fund that's Vanguard, it's VIG, you can say, well, it's Vanguard. But
What's that supposed to do?
If it underperforms by 20 percentage points, then, you know, I say, hey, it's Vanguard. It's high quality aristocrat. It's a, I mean, great marketing, by the way, aristocrats.
Listeners, if you're looking for more information on the comparisons, the white papers Meb was referencing was, it's on our website under Investing Insights. I think it's called Think Income and Growth Don't Exist in This Market. Think Again. And then the sister papers, Think Income and Growth Don't Exist Around the Globe. Think Again. So you can check out the various comparisons.
If you hear that ripping sound, that's me opening a green Kit Kat. If anyone's ever been to Japan, they have all sorts of like 50 different Kit Kat flavors. And we had a coworker come back from Japan. So we are not eating. I am eating a green Kit Kat. Jeff would never touch a green Kit Kat.
Well, that's why I'm going to survive that fun run or whatever. And you're going to be keeling over dying.
I'm calorie loading a month ahead of time. I think it's September 28th, listeners, by the way. I'm calorie loading to get a little buffer. Buffer around the belly.
Do you want to talk about just your CrossFit strategy a while ago where they had that contest and you thought that you would
it was who could lose the most, who could become the fittest over the course of a month or quarter. I can't remember which, but it was like who could lose the most fat percentage.
It was a body fat.
So I was going to try to, you know, game the contest by upping my fat percentage a week or two ahead of the. It didn't work.
Well, no, what
I basically just got fatter for 2 weeks and then plateaued for a month.
I think that's what happened is you got fatter and then like something popped up and you couldn't be in the contest anymore. So nothing happened. Anyway, all right. Back to Vanguard. Despite the article, they just had an announcement. Pretty great for investors along with Fidelity. Want to fill us in on those?
Are you talking about the no fee fund?
Yep.
Fidelity Zero. Well, hopefully it was our rumor of doing this for the last couple of years that caused them to do this, because we never really actually wanted to launch this. We just wanted to stir up the pot a little bit and cause mass panic and confusion in the industry. So Fidelity came out with the announcement that they're launching a couple zero fee mutual funds, market cap weighted. And even if they don't ever launch them, it got them publicity in every single publication around the world. They got a ton of attention. So good for them. And there was a lot of confusion when they launched. Why are they doing this? How are they doing this? And I had assumed that they were going to do it the route that we express makes sense, which is launching them at zero fee, but keeping the short lending revenue. That's not what they're doing. They're just launching them for free. And you have to have an account at Fidelity. So they're basically using it as a huge lead gen to try to get people into other Fidelity products, open accounts. It's basically a toaster. They're giving away toasters to try to get people in. And people were like, oh my God, how are they going to make money? This is the end of the industry. What in the world? And then our buddy Eric Balkunas from Bloomy started tweeting. He said, look, you don't need to worry about Fidelity. Their annual revenue is almost $20 billion. Their revenue alone is 2x the entire ETF industry. So, you know, this is kind of going back to everyone's like, oh my God, index funds are crushing all the old school active managers, which is true. And all the assets are flowing towards low fee, better products like ETFs, low cost ETFs, which is true. But still, these old school shops that have many of them trillions in assets, it's such a long runway and they have so much money and so much cash in the meantime. So anyway, it's an interesting product. But when you go back to the baseline and say we're comparing apples to apples, you know, they already had a total market index fund that was at 1 basis point or 2 basis points. So really all they did was just say, hey, we're going to go from 2 to 0. Whoop-de-doo.
Wrapping up the publicity in the meantime.
Yeah. So this goes back to our whole articles we've been writing over the past couple of years about what a wonderful time it is to be an investor. People don't understand already, and we've said this many times, every time we say it, it surprises people. There's already zero fee and negative fee funds, because if you have a fund, say an ETF that's at 20 basis points, and if they're a good custodian, a good steward of your capital, they'll do some short lending and then return it to the shareholders. So that 20 basis points might actually be a negative 10, 20, 30, 50 basis points. In other words, you're getting paid to own the fund. It has a negative expense ratio, which is really cool. The problem is it's harder to find the short lending revenue information. So it's not like you're going to go on Morningstar, type in a fund, and it'll say minus 0.5. You know, it'll say 0.2. So it's a little harder to compare apples to apples around this world. But these tentacles extend into every aspect of the investment business. So Jason Zweig had a good article where he was talking about all the other ways that brokerages make money. So people said, how is Robinhood going to make money when they don't have any commissions? Well, a lot of people don't know this, but brokerages make about half their money from hosing you on your cash balance. So if you have a cash balance, say you just keep 10%, 50%, 100% in cash, the default for many of these brokerages is either zero or it's a money market fund that maybe get, I don't know, 20 basis points or something, when that fund could easily in a CD or other money market funds that aren't from the parent company be earning 1.5%, maybe even 2% now. So all of a sudden, they're earning that spread of 2 percentage points. This is what Schwab got into big trouble, not big trouble, but they got bad publicity when they launched their robo, which was free, no commissions, but they forced you to have a huge cash chunk, which they then earned the spread on. So you got to kind of add in all these costs, and there's a lot of different ways to think about it. So you just got to be careful, as always, all the different ways you could potentially be getting skimmed off or fleeced or et cetera.
Yeah, Zweig's article on that was interesting, making the point about the sweeps and how, you know, you have a right to be more in control of how these brokerages are using your money. But at present, there's really not a whole hell of a lot you can do. You're just sort of subject to it. And it's all legal. It's not.
It'd be cool if there was a brokerage, and readers, maybe there is. So email me. I think Michael Kitsis was talking about this, where it says, tell you what, we're going to be totally transparent and we're going to only charge like a basis point fee or something. We'll charge you 10 basis points. But we're not going to charge you commissions. We'll act not necessarily as a fiduciary, but we'll act in your best interest in every way possible. So the sweep accounts will go into a good vehicle that's going to earn you high interest instead of some junk. We're not going to sell like all this crazy order flow to give you bad executions. You know, just like it's like almost like a fiduciary brokerage, but they'll charge a reasonable fee for doing it.
Start it.
No.
Anything else on the Zweig article you want to talk on?
You know, the short lending is an interesting area because there's not a whole, unless you're super high net worth, there's not a whole lot of brokerages that will do the short lending for you and distribute the revenue. And it can be a very material revenue source.
How many basis points are we talking here, ballpark?
Some, like if it's a US S&P 500 stock fund, you're literally talking basis points. So a couple basis points probably. And most regulated funds can only lend out about a third of their shares. So you're only optimizing on the highest fee products, but for stuff like maybe foreign or emerging, for biotech, for real estate, you could easily be getting 50 to 100 basis points. So already covers the cost of the management fee. And then in some areas, we had a Corey Hofstein or somebody I was talking, I can't even remember who, we were talking about it. It might've been Jake at Econompic, where he said the lending rate on HYG ETF is like 2 percentage points. I said, Meb, you should do an ETF that just buys HYG and lends it out. And all of a sudden you have a negative 150 basis point expense ratio. Just call it HYGG. I don't know. That's a hilarious idea. But ironically, it's like a viable, interesting concept. So, but most investors don't do any sort of short lending. But in many cases, you got to be careful because your brokerages might, and they might be keeping it. So ideally would be a situation. This is the beauty of ETFs. Is that most of the providers launch the funds and return the short lending to the consumer. And so they're being good guys in the scenario.
All right. Well, why don't we transition from that now to another one of your tweets? Let's get into some valuations. You had a chart from Luthold that shows how one measure of the market has matched its 2000 valuation level and another has doubled. Now, specifically, we're talking about the S&P 500 median price to sales. And we're talking about the S&P 500 cap-weighted price to sales. So let's combine that with another one of your tweets. Longboard released a study. Well, actually, it was a chart referencing a Goldman market study that claims, quote, in 99% of the time at current valuation levels, equity returns have been single digit or negative. All right, so we put all this together right now, and I want to get your take on the market valuation in a second. I know it's going to be obviously we're frothy, but are we at a point where you're saying, all right, obviously I'm not going to allocate more to US equities at this point, but are we at a point where you would actually recommend trimming down a position based upon where the investor is? Because hell, you know, it's better to sell and maybe hit some taxes versus sit through 30% if it's going to have that kind of a drawdown next few years, but you don't know. So how do you analyze it?
I think you should sell it all. U.S. stock, look, we've been saying this for a while. U.S. stocks are expensive. You know, we love referencing CAPE ratio. People pull their hair out, gnash their teeth when it comes to CAPE. I don't know why. almost any other method of valuation. If you look at the chart you mentioned from Luthold, price to sales hitting all-time highs, every single valuation chart says the same thing. And every single tangential valuation chart says the same thing, like percentage of your portfolio in stocks. You know, that's levels that predict low future returns. But that's the way valuation works, is it can always get higher. GMO, I was tweeting, I think they got to their highest negative prediction I've seen for the next 7 years for U.S. stocks is minus 5% per year real for the next 7 years.
That's Grantham.
That's GMO, yeah, stinky. They manage $80 billion. But, you know, I mean, it is what it is. It's, I think, as I mentioned 1,000 times before, for me, it's like a green, yellow, red stoplight. The valuation gets you to the yellow flashing light. And for me, the red light is trend. So when the U.S. market is still in an uptrend, chugging along, it's when it finally rolls over to me, that's the red flashing light. Not there yet, but certainly it's...
But you will not sit by as a passive buy and hold. You will get out actively.
Well, I mean, all of our quant strategies do that already. So we have a strategy that hedges half the portfolio based on valuation, half based on trend. It's been hedged on valuation for years now, and trend... It's not. So it's about a 50% net long. Anything that's momentum and trend based is in US now, because US is still clobbering everything else. US dollar is going up. That's having effects on commodities. That's having effects on emerging markets. So US is ironically one of the highest yielding currencies and bond markets in the world. That's crazy to think of, but it almost made it into our sovereign high yield fund. That's weird to think about. It's like a bunch of emerging markets and potentially the US. US isn't quite there yet, but it's close. So it's the same old, nothing new to talk about. Just US is expensive.
While we're on the topic of CAPE and valuation, let's jump ahead. Actually, let's try to make this a little bit more logical in terms of our ordering. We have a Q&A write-in question. Let me go ahead and just knock that out while we're here. It says, assuming the US economy does not enter a recession in the near future, Shiller PE 10-year earnings average will soon consist of all economic boom and no bust as the depressed earnings of 2008 and 2009 roll out of its calculation. Average earnings will increase and the Shiller PE will likely appear less expensive. So is this a issue of how useful the CAPE is when it only includes a period of profit expansion? How do we handle this?
We did an article many years ago that said, what if 2008 never happened? And we just sliced out 2008 and said earnings stayed consistent. And basically, it has the effect of causing CAPE to go from whatever it is now, let's call it 33 to like 30.
That's it?
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole point of the CAPE is it's 10 years worth. You could do 15 years, you could do 20 years, you could do 5 years. None of them matter. They all say the same thing, which is kind of the whole point. You want these very broad measures of what matters. And so it's funny because back when 2008, 2009 happened and people would criticize CAPE, depending on their investment stance, bullish or bearish, they'd say, no, you can't use 2008 because it's depressed earnings. Obviously, that's going to have a huge effect when they roll off. Therefore, CAPE should be lower and I'm bullish. But the same people also said, no, Meb, you can't use 2007. Those earnings were distorted to the upside because of all what's going on with the real estate market was in a bubble and all these other things. You obviously can't use 2007. Ergo, CAPE should be higher and you should be bearish on this. You know, so people see what they want to see, but that's the whole point is your valuation is a very blunt tool. The valuations in my mind tell you you're going to have pretty meager returns. It's not like specific to two decimals where you're like going to have minus 2.89% per year. That's just not the way it works. Your old astronomy, your old Hubble telescope example.
Oh, yeah. That was a good.
Jeff was a big nerd astronomer as a child.
Remember what it was?
Yeah, you were talking about discounted cash flows. What piece was this? Was it in one of our pieces? It was in one of our written pieces.
Yeah.
You want to repeat it?
Something like changing the interest rate and your DCF calculation is a bit like the Hubble telescope. Move either one a centimeter and all of a sudden you're looking at a new galaxy.
Yep, that's it. Thank you, Galileo.
There you go. All right. So jumping from frothy valuations to discounted valuations, you touched on GMO a minute ago, but another one of your tweets was referencing how GMO, might have been the same thing, but how GMO believes emerging markets are the biggest opportunity relative to other assets in the last 20 plus years. One question on this. I've looked at a lot of these large cap emerging market ETFs, and a lot of them seem to have substantial exposure to China and just Asia in general. So is that what you have in mind when you think about emerging markets, or would it be better off to capture more of an equal weight emerging markets that's not quite as weighted towards just Asia?
Real quick before we get there, I just remembered, you know, it's funny when I tweeted this about GMO, you got this litany of people that were like, how long, they're so bearish, oh my God, how long till they go out of business? And I just find the guys like, do you realize like they managed and still manage, they managed like 140 billion. Now they manage still like almost 100. You're not going out of business if you manage $100 billion. What are you talking about? But there's a classically GMO and Grantham, you know, during the 2000 bubble, lost about half their assets while clients left during the late technology boom and then came back in spades after the bear market. But it's just funny to read people's responses because these guys are always bearish. And I said, well, that's interesting. I went and looked up the March 2009 projection for equity returns. And for US, it ranged from 9 to 15%.
GMO said that in 2009?
Yeah, right, because it's the bottom of the bear market, right? And so high quality was something like 14 or 15% per year for the next 7 years. So people love to get, you know, negative about people projecting something against their worldview. Anyway, I think it's interesting. But so to this EM chart, they had published a chart that says the margin of superiority. So they looked at all the assets they track, and the one that's number one, which for them right now is emerging markets, what's the spread between that and the second best asset? And so right now, it's the highest margin you've ever seen. So emerging markets look better versus everything else, and it's not even close. Now, this isn't, in their mind, this is not necessarily a just ringing endorsement of emerging markets, but rather it's just everything else is so bad. So if you look back to the 1999 bubble, there are at least places to hide. So small caps, dividend paying stocks, even real estate, commodities, bonds, all those did fine through the tech bubble. But the example right now is a lot of people have coined the term everything bubble, where a lot of stuff just looks more expensive. Now, I disagree. I think foreign, developed, and emerging are quite a bit cheaper. And I think you can actually potentially see double-digit returns in the cheap stuff. So,
well, even foreign developed, I know EM's pretty good, but you still think there's a lot of good foreign developed? So
I like foreign developed and emerging, but if you look at the cheapest countries or parts of the world, a lot of that happens to be in foreign developed. So if you had to choose one or the other, emerging markets are cheaper than developed markets. So if you look at CAPE ratios, for example, US is at 33, foreign developed maybe 22, I'm spitballing here. Emerging markets, maybe 15. So there's no question emerging markets cheaper. However, if you just look at the cheapest bucket, a lot of the cheapest countries are still developed markets. Think a lot of Europe, right? Depends how you want to characterize Greece. But anyway, so going to emerging markets, and again, this is it's so much simpler than people make it out to be. A lot of these countries are, US is hitting new highs. A lot of these countries are down 40, 60, 80%. And Turkey pretty soon going to be down 99%, 99.9%. They've just been puking, very quickly getting into the cheapest bucket, the cheapest of the cheapest bucket. We still have Russia as the cheapest, but not by far. So anyway, back to your question.
Yes.
About China.
Yep.
As Donald Trump would pronounce it, China. There's the quant side of me, and then there's the sort of subjective side of me. The subjective side of me loves the China story. Loves it because I think Chinese equities are cheap. Loves it for a long-term play. And even on the quant side, Chinese equities are cheap, okay? And it's a big story, Sugarood, the podcast, go back and listen to it. A lot of people have talked about it. As China gets added to a lot of these indices, there's a lot of dollars that have to flow into China regardless of whether they want to or not. By mandate, a lot of these indexes have had underexposure to China. They're going to be forced to buy it over the coming years. So I'm in particular a bull on China. But your question wasn't really that. Your question was kind of how do you weight emerging market exposure.
Right.
So it's funny because, again, do you characterize certain countries as developed or as emerging or as frontier? And sometimes they come in and out. It's like that soccer leagues in Europe, right? Where you win, you move up to the next bracket, you lose, you go down, et cetera. So some of it's a little bit arbitrary, but emerging markets currently, China's the biggest chunk and by far. But it goes back to the age-old question, you know, do you create these arbitrary geographic style and size buckets? So geographic being US, foreign developed, foreign emerging frontier, style being value and growth, but any other factor, and size being large cap, mid cap, small cap. Or you just say, hey, I'm totally agnostic and I'm going to go bottom up and buy the 200 cheapest stocks around the world, wherever they may be, and have constraints based on sectors. There's a million different ways to skin the cat. And I've said, using one of our funds compared to like one of Wes's funds as an example, totally different mandates. They end up in the same place because when you broadly do value, you end up in a lot of the same places. It's kind of a shotgunny, you know, the overlap, but also you're avoiding the really expensive stuff. So if you were to say, Meb, how are you going to do emerging markets? My entire 401k, because we can't use Cambry funds, just defaults into a market cap weighted Vanguard emerging market fund every month and dollar cost average in.
So I'm assuming that does overweight you in Asia.
Yeah. Well, compared to the global market cap, I mean, compared to the global market cap or compared to emerging markets?
Emerging markets.
Well, it's not an overweight because that is the market cap. But yes, well, yeah, you are highly exposed to Asia.
Right. But my question, though, I guess is, I mean, yes, I agree. And that's all as it should be. But if you're really trying to play emerging markets and capture all the potential gains from these various countries that have great low capes that are probably lower than China, is there no room to say, all right, 10% Russia, 10% China, 10% Greece, and you just keep rolling
off? Now you're describing our largest fund. Thank you. Right, there's a million different ways to do it, and providers have a lot of different methodologies, but value to me is still a totally reasonable approach. I mean, market cap is a great first step. Adding value, adding other ideas, I think are totally reasonable.
All right. Anything else on this one?
No.
All right. Next tweet. Moving from valuation, let's get into some biases. You had a chart that demonstrates investor allocation by region here in the United States. And the takeaway is that home country bias doesn't just apply to stocks and your country. It also applies to industries in your region. It's an interesting sort of graphic of how out here on the West Coast, a lot of people are overweight technology and they're underweight technology in other parts of the country. So one question for you, Meb, how much of this sort of behavioral bias based upon a region, how much of that really is bad investing versus qualified plans, people investing in their own countries or own companies that are specific to that region?
So much of the bias out there and so much of the what goes on in investing is just people just kind of letting it fluctuate and ride. So the allocation by region, the West is higher exposure to tech, Texas higher exposure to energy, Midwest, industrials, Northeast, financials. That all makes sense. But it's probably because, yeah, like you mentioned, everybody in New York City works at banks who then have put their, foolishly, by the way, put their retirement plan also in the company's stock. Same thing that people did at Enron in Texas, much to their dismay and detriment. Same thing that people do in Silicon Valley with tech. And they just let it ride. But it is still a very active bet and it's still one you need to be aware of. It may be smart, you may be making it intentionally, but still an active bet. Same thing with US versus foreign. I think it's very foolish. A lot of people say, no, I want a huge home country bias in the US. I'm comfortable with it. And I say, fine, go for it. But I think it's a very foolish, uncompensated for risk. You know, there's some anecdotal sort of tangential evidence that happens, like magazine cover stuff. So we recently saw Robert Knott was talking about the US, if you look at it, or sorry, the largest companies in the world by decade. And usually it's a mix, but during certain periods when certain countries are doing much better, mid-2000s China, 80s Japan, you know, you see the representation of what percentage of the top 10 are where. And right now, I don't remember if it's the top 10 is all US, but it's pretty darn close and it's pretty much all tech, which is crazy because you go back a few years and it's a mix of all sorts of different countries, you know, in the top 10. Part of that is a good example where recently Apple just hit the trillion market cap mark. First stock, first company to ever hit a trillion. We actually had a article from Brian Taylor, who was on the podcast from Global Financial Data, who had compiled the firsts for various milestones, which I thought was really cool. The first $1 million market cap in the US was Bank of North America. The first 10 million market cap, Bank of the US. First 100 million market cap, New York Central Railroad. First $1 billion, AT&T. First $10 billion, GM. First $100 billion, GE. and first trillion Apple. And then if you do it globally, it's even more interesting because, again, going back to the same example, it's the U.S. The whole snow globe isn't just the U.S., but first million-dollar company in the world was Dutch East India Company. Famous, very famous company. First 10 million, same thing. First 100 million, another famous company, Mississippi Company. First billion, AT&T. First 10 billion, GM, also U.S. First 100 billion, Nippon Telegraph and Telephone Company. It's Japan. And then first trillion, I said Apple, but I think it was actually PetroChina, briefly, which has since just gotten murdered from the Chinese and commodity bubble in the mid-2000s, and that's deflated. So now it's just Apple. And historically, it's funny, anytime a company has hit 4% of market cap in the U.S., as a percentage of the stock market, it's been like the death knell. It really struggled afterwards.
We talked about on the show with somebody. Yeah. Who was that?
I don't know. Probably me.
Like returns going forward were anemic.
It's probably me and you. We're having flashbacks. Listeners, Jeff started microdosing LSD during the podcast. So if he starts saying some weird words. No, so that was, we talked about it. It might have been Luthold because they've published charts on it. But it's sort of one of those things that are interesting. It's kind of an artifact of data mining because there's plenty of other countries where stocks represent 10 or 20% or even sectors where they represent way more. But in the US, historically, that's been the bar. That's been really hard for stocks to get above that 4% mark.
Gotcha.
Again, it's just color on the painting of when everything in the globe, all the biggest stocks are US, when US is outperforming everything, when the US is, you know, one of the most expensive countries in the world. Those are all sort of the same data point expressed five different ways.
It's interesting. There's the, you know, what you just mentioned would serve as a bit of a red flag for Apple, or at least to sort of invest with caution. But then the news we just got either today or yesterday was that Buffett had either increased or held his large position in Apple.
Well, don't forget the news is always good for the stuff hitting new highs. Like the news is always good when you're on the left side of the chart where you're hitting new highs. Like that's the whole point. That's how you got there. The news is always bad with stuff that's cheap. But personally, I do agree. I love Apple. I think it's not very expensive. It's in some of our portfolios quantitatively. We're not picking it. I think, by the way, listeners, if you don't own a pair of AirPods, it is the single best product I've bought in probably the last 5 years.
That's an amazing exaggeration.
It is. Name something better. I said the other thing is my... What?
That you bought?
Yeah. My other thing is my levitating plant, the life planner. That's up there. But...
The one I destroyed with the pin?
Yeah. If I lost AirPods, I would immediately replace them. They're magical. Just full of delight. You need to get a pair. I'm serious. When you do your run walks...
This happened. This should go back to that segment we did a couple of years ago on the show. The something I find useful, magical.
Beautiful, useful, magical. Whatever. It's the best thing I've purchased in years. Hmm. Listeners, get a pair.
All right.
If you use special code MEB, I'm just kidding.
All right. Let's move on to private investing, VCs. You had a graphic that with the title "Monthly Count of VC Deals Raising 100 Million or More Worldwide Since 2007." And the takeaway basically is from 2007 to 14, that number hovered around 5 per month. Starting close to 2017, the number skyrocketed. Now it's at nearly 40 and it has a vertical slope. So is VC in a bubble? What's going on there? You're doing a lot of investing in that.
I've actually started to see increasing amounts of bad behavior.
What does that look like?
Well, a couple of things. One is sort of like misleading efforts. I saw a write-up. I mean, the biggest challenge of the private is buyer beware because you just don't have that much information. And so I had a syndicate come across where I read through it and I'm like, oh, I remember this. I was like one of the first people, I'm friends with the founder. I was one of the first people to like download his app from 3 years ago. And then I emailed him. I was like, dude, congrats on the new round. I'm excited to participate. I'm going to kick you some cash. I want to follow you. I like you, et cetera. And he wrote back. He's like, hey, thanks, man. The news isn't actually public. Where'd you hear about it? And I said, oh, there's a syndicate going on for investors. And he said, oh, that's interesting. Can you let me know where you saw that? Because that's not authorized. Hmm. I said, that's weird. And sent it to him. And I said, oh, that's a bummer. Okay. And then got news that the syndicate was closed. And then a few days later, they said, oh, there's a new syndicate, Meb. Do you want to invest in this company? And I said, sure.
Wait. And I wrote it back. Was the syndicate trying to solicit your money and they were going to just walk away with it and then close down?
No, I don't think it's fraud. I mean, if I had to guess what happened is that, let's say like a VC got a $2 million allocation and somebody at the VC or somebody related to it is trying to carve out their own separate little allocation so that they get paid the carry instead of the company or something. I don't know. It happened a second time. I am out and I go, oh, I see you figured it out. I'm looking forward to participating. He said, are you kidding me? He said, no, this isn't legit. And so he said, tell you what, I'll just let you invest through the actual real round. Just give me your information and we'll do it. But
that's sketchy.
Yeah. And then the other one I saw was, and I think most of them are legit. Look, let's be honest. I mean, again, it's buyer beware. Like if you invest in a brewery and the brewery goes to zero, that's on you and that's fine. But at least like make it real. So not be misleading. Another one was doing a round. Let's say, hey, they're growing revenue last year, 50% growth from 2 to 3 million. So as I do, I was Googling and spending time researching the company, trying to find information, reach out to friends. And the company's been around for a while and has done a pivot, I think. But a couple of years ago, was doing like 12 million in revenue. And I said, how? And I emailed the guy. I said, by the way, just this company, it seems like it was doing 12 million in revenue, not. It's kind of misleading to say it's doing 2 and is now growing 50% year over year to 3 million when it used to be doing 12. And he goes, no, that's not true. And I just like sent him the link. So I was like, look, this was in this magazine, and never heard back. I was like, that's pretty like sketchy of you to be sending this out to everyone. It's like really misleading. Or you have done no homework, in which case it's also embarrassing. But you start to see, I mean, having done about 50 of these deals, you see a very large separation between, I think, the really excellent leads. And I would put some of our guests on there, Phil Nadel, Jason Calcanis, a couple others. They require pro rata rights. They say the companies have to do updates, all this good behavior. And then it's like almost everyone else.
Well, how did you...
So many of these companies just don't even do updates whatsoever.
All right. So if we have listeners out there who are on AngelList or whatever, and they're looking for syndicate leads to follow, sure, there's some big names like Nadel, Rubalcava, but... Besides that, if you're trying to find anybody new, are you shooting from the hip? And because it sounds like you've found a couple sort of side tangential guys to follow, and obviously a couple of them are kind of flaking on you a little bit.
If you remember back to the early days of me starting to do this, I said, look, I'm going to spend some money doing this. I expect it to be tuition. If I lose all of it, fine. And it's actually worked out great so far, knock on wood, but I consider this tuition. I want to learn. There's no way I'll follow this to the extent that I need to without putting real money to work. So I'm going to spend the time. And so having done this, I've started to filter out the guys that are kind of clowns and the guys that are legit.
All right. So tell our listeners, what is one of the filtration methods?
And part of this is personal. I don't understand why anyone would not give updates. Even yearly, quarterly is fine, monthly, great. But like so many of these companies just do no updates. And I don't understand that as a founder, as an entrepreneur, as an investor, because what is your biggest resource? It's this magical group of people that's given you money, is an invested, interested in seeing you succeed. You should be using them as a springboard, you know, as a resource, not as a antagonistic, oh, I don't have time for you sort of thing. Like that's absurd. So that's one for me, but that's personal. Some people don't care about updates, right? I think that's crazy. Anyway, so, but we talked about some of the bad behavior going on the podcast with, I think it was Jason too and Phil. And so I don't know how you would avoid it other than spending the time following people.
Had you, going back to your previous example, had you not known that founder and reached out to him personally, you think you would have sent in money? And was that just going
to
be one of those?
I tried to send in money.
But was that going to be one of those just hard learning lessons where you think that was just going to be gone, written it off?
Well, it's not gone. It's not like someone's just, it's not like a Ponzi scheme or fraud where they're keeping the money. I think that it's, in that specific case, it was just not authorized. It was someone trying, my guess is it's someone trying to peel off their own piece of the pie.
Okay. But so fair enough. So I mean, it wouldn't have been that bad, but let's say it was a little more nefarious in nature. It was... The deck they sent you, I mean, would you have bought on it in terms of good revenues? Everything looked fine.
Well, I love the idea, which is funny because and I don't want to get into the specific company or even the website, but the first idea was so nonsensical and you guys actually downloaded it and used it. And the second idea they pivoted to immediately, I was like, oh yeah, this is brilliant. This is so much better. But it's so funny because a phrase I have referring to a specific company who also not be named The funny thing is Silicon Valley pivot is seen as like a fan. It's like the best thing. Like, hey, congrats, kudos. You realize your business is failing, pivot to something else. But I love the phrase that Silicon Valley calls it a pivot. The rest of the country just calls you being full of shit. You know, so in so many cases where someone, in the case where it's like you believe something and it's a philosophy and then you shift to something else, people are just like, really, dude? Like, come on. But if it's a business model and you're actually trying to find product market fit, it's beautiful. It's a wonderful thing.
Gotta be nimble.
It's a fine line in some areas of our world.
It's a nice euphemism.
Yeah, you feel free to steal it. Just cite me.
But there was like two other really horrible pieces of behavior that crossed my mind. And what was the other one? The other one was this magazine says, hey, Meb, good news, we're writing a profile of Cambria in this published magazine that many people on this podcast listen to or read. Can we talk on the phone so we can like get a little more background? I said, sure. And I said, oh, by the way, just FYI, just so we can help, you know, we're writers, so we can help keep the lights on here. We actually asked the profiles to sponsor, you know, an advertising campaign in the issue. I said, well, we don't do any advertising. So just that's a no. And he's basically like, okay, well, I guess we're not going to do it. I was like, oh, wait, that's the prerequisite? By the way, there's another one. If any of you have fallen through this for this next one, then this is on you. I get emails at least once a quarter, maybe once a month from a production studio. I think it's based in Florida, not surprising. And they do segments on whatever your industry is. The old ones used to be narrated by Shatner, and the new ones, or Larry King, and the new one is Rob Lowe. I got one yesterday and there's like, hey, Meb, we'd love to feature Cambria in a segment on global investing, and Rob Lowe will narrate it and like help produce it. And I haven't responded to the last 75 of these emails, but it's like 20 grand. I remember talking to you about the Shatner one.
Shatner.
It looked good on the surface. And then you spend 5 minutes looking into it and they basically want you to open up your wallet.
So many scammer. Every turn, there's just scammers everywhere. What were we even talking? Oh, so going way back to the original question, which was talking about VCs. Look, when money is sloshing around, you're a 10 bull market, people can call it QE, whatever. When there's a lot of money to be had, you see a lot of particular nonsense going on, right? The percentage of these ICOs that are failing is like 90 some percent. That's where you talk about, by the way, people absconding with your money. Good luck. I can't even name a single ICO that has a product or a business that anyone uses. Can you? I can't.
Not a fan.
Anyway, yeah, let's go talk about when there's all this money sloshing around, you have cryptos and all the funds are charging three. It's so private equity and venture capital funds are at record levels of fundraising. And what are they possibly going to spend all this money on? The private equity guys, when we were talking on the Rasmussen episode, it just causes the valuation to go up and up. And almost all the evidence shows that all the returns come from buying low valuations. But do you think all these Blackstones of the world are going to sit on that cash or return it to shareholders? Yeah, right. You're getting 2 and 20, you're going to find something to buy.
Great episode.
That leads you to Tesla.
Great older episode of Silicon Valley where they were talking about the valuation at which the company should go out, and they were getting offers for whatever, 100 million or whatever. And the astute VC's advice was, go out at 25 so you have more ability to grow and you're not sort of pegged to this high valuation where you can expand from there. So I guess that's not what we're seeing now, though.
A lot of money out there.
All right. One more tweet from you, then let's hop into a couple listener Q&As. You posted on an article titled, Do Americans Have Enough Emergency Savings? So it went on to kind of give the same spiel everybody has heard, which is basically that it's not that clients don't understand the need for a savings fund, they just don't have enough in mind. Meb, you are a big proponent of written financial plans. And we kind of touched on that in our investment pyramid piece. But for listeners with smaller capital bases and for younger listeners, you know, what's the suggestion for the balance between having enough savings in cash or a money market to help out in case of an emergency, but it's really doing nothing for you, no real returns, no interest, versus the need to have, you know, your money working for you and the benefits of long-term compounding. But if you have it working for you, then you don't necessarily have it as readily available if things go bad. So, you know, how do you find that balance, and have you written that out yourself?
You touched on a number of different topics here. The first is the woeful state of most Americans' savings. And that's kind of terrible. And again, it goes back to, it's easy to give this advice, but if people are living paycheck to paycheck, it's hard to really get by. Now, there's a whole movement of people that are trying to live more frugal lifestyles. Mr. Money Mustache is a famous one, you know, Colorado actually guy. So it's easy to say, probably harder to do in reality. So there's a trade-off when you're living on the bubble of survival day to day, month to month, of the desperation of putting money away slash enjoying today, you know? So, but how many examples have we seen of frugal people that have saved money and become multimillionaires? So many of the janitor, of the teacher, of everyone who just thoughtfully saved and put away money. So it's doable. It's absolutely doable in making reasonable decisions. As much guff as I give Dave Ramsey on his investment advice, I think his personal finance advice is almost universally fantastic, which is you don't need to buy a $50,000 car when a $5,000 one will do. Stuff like that. So it's tough. But yes, I think it's important to have a buffer. Life is so much simpler when you don't have credit card debt, other sorts of debt, and you have a cash balance. It's a big sleep at night sort of thing. I think you and I both can relate to that. We've had periods where life with debt and uncertainty it's kind of miserable.
Mm-hmm.
On the flip side, let's get into a philosophical discussion, which is, let's say you do have some assets. A lot of people have what they call an emergency fund or cash balances, etc. And we discussed earlier in the show, cash balances often get pay you zero. Your Bank of America account, probably zero. If you have a sweep, you might, depending if it's a conflicted brokerage, you may get 10, 20, 30 basis points, but you really should be earning more in a CD or bonds. But the interesting debate, and I'm trying to convince our friend Dan Egan at Betterment to write this article because it was originally his idea. It's what he does in practice in real life, but I consider him to be somewhat of an outlier. He actually uses his brokerage account as a checking account, pays bills, everything. And he uses it, the default is his investment account at Betterment. And so this is fascinating to me because I said, okay, most people would never do that because of the fluctuations. You run the risk of having a drawdown. You run the risk of month-to-month volatility. But if you flip it on its head, say, okay, let's say you just invested your checking account, emergency account in the cheapest possible, risk-free asset T-bills, okay? Historically, that's gotten you about 1% after inflation. However, due to inflation, that's lost 13% in a year, and it's also had a 50% drawdown. So there's a fun thought experiment. If you say, okay, if you invest in the global market portfolio, a diversified portfolio of stocks and bonds, yada, 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 you could be earning instead of 1% a year, 5% a year, real. So, or call it, you know, instead of it being 4% nominal, back when interest rates were 4%, instead of 4%, you could be earning 10% for probably not much more volatility and drawdowns. And so all of a sudden, you're the old copywriter, the headline could be something that's like how your savings account could yield 3% more per year. And essentially no more risk, no more volatility. And it's an interesting concept. It's philosophical. Wait. It's a philosophical one.
I'm not fully following how you set this up. Because if I'm writing checks on some account, it's got to be completely liquid. I can write checks on it. But you're also saying you're investing T-bills. Help me understand.
My comparison was, okay, let's say here's your Bank of America account. And let's say you have $100,000 in it.
Yes.
And let's say, you know, and that $100,000 is going to earn, if you put it in the default Bank of America, probably nothing. If you optimize it, you'll maybe make $1,000 a year. However, if you put it in a Betterment account, as an example, that is investing that money, and you make the historical return 5-10%, all of a sudden that $1,000 is actually 5 or 10 yield.
All right. So, are you saying then I have to sort of realize a gain to get the cash to pay my electric bill, though?
I think the beauty of a Betterment account and a lot of these accounts is they optimize your withdrawals and deposits for taxable purposes. So it's an interesting takeaway. So the takeaway being, if you're comfortable with a little more volatility on a nominal basis, then in the long run, it's actually quite a big benefit to keep your money invested rather than keep it in nothing.
Idle cash kills long run, but
I don't know if it kills.
I think it's dangerous.
Murders people.
But then it goes back to the idea of that we've talked about is like, at what point does it make sense to kind of wait, keep your money on the side and hold out for a big chunk allocation versus putting it in? We've talked about this a million times. Like,
but that's like more of a new money, new shift strategy. Someone right. inherits $1 million sort of thing.
Right. But still, I think that's a good paper idea.
But again, that's why the preface of this conversation, I said it's a philosophical question. Because on math, you should invest it. There's no question you should invest it instead of it letting it sit in the money market account.
But that's just the paper. At some point, I remember us talking about this, and you're like, at certain valuations, it does potentially make sense if you have a chunk, not just your sort of daily, you know, monthly $100, $300. If you have a big chunk, there might be certain valuations at which you say, nah, I'm not going to put in $500,000.
You dollar cost average because as the market eventually comes down, but I'm talking about a diversified world allocation, not just if you're going to invest in U.S. stocks.
Anyway,
fun idea. We'll drag Dan on here and make him defend himself and talk about it a little bit. I think it'd be a lot of fun.
All right. Few listener Q&As. We already tackled one on CAPE a minute ago. Let's talk about momentum funds. So we got a question here that says, are momentum funds just camouflaging another factor? For instance, if value became the in factor, wouldn't momentum pick it up? So momentum would then just look like a value fund.
There's plenty of times when factors overlap. And so I think a lot of the work currently being done is on a lot of other factors besides value and what their valuation looks like at times. So people will say, hey, here's the low vol factor. Research affiliate's been doing a lot of this and says, but you really only get compensated when the low vol factor is cheap. You shouldn't be buying it when it's expensive, which is totally makes sense. Now, the implementation, I think, is a little bit harder. So there are times where we mentioned dividend stocks are cheap. So there's overlap there, late 90s. There are times when dividend stocks are expensive right now. So there are times when value and momentum intersect, and there's other times when momentum is purely buying the fangs. So who knows? My favorite, as we've talked about many times, is when value and momentum intersect. So then you start to get into, should you treat factors individually where you're buying a value fund and a momentum fund, or should you buy multi-factor funds where you're buying both in the same? I lean towards the latter. Most of our funds are multi-factor, but I'm somewhat agnostic. So yes, if you buy a momentum fund, you may end up with a bunch of utilities companies. Other times you may end up a bunch of expensive tech, and sometimes you may end up with a bunch of cheap tech. Who knows?
You ever try to personally sort of rank tilts? Like, let's say momentum was cheap, value is cheap.
This is the AQR side of it, where they say it's really hard to time factors. We did this probably a decade ago on the blog, back when we used to talk a lot more about currencies. I feel like in a different life, Jeff, you would probably been really interested in currencies instead of options. Have you ever traded options on currencies? Maybe that's the perfect, talking about overlap.
There's a rabbit hole we don't want to go down right now.
So, but we looked at, example, carry, which is simply yield in bonds or currencies globally. And carry got pummeled in the financial crisis, but the basket of the stuff you're buying versus the basket of the stuff you're shorting, it was the same analysis. When the basket that you were buying was cheap, returns were a lot better. When the basket you're buying is expensive, returns are a lot worse. It makes sense. So anyway, and then the currency is purchasing power parity, but with stocks, you could do price earnings, cash flow, whatever. Same sort of theory, but I think the challenge is not as easy to implement as the theory sounds.
All right. So bottom line is it's not always going to pick up something else. It's not going to be correct. The camouflage. All right. We just covered the one on CAPE a minute ago. So next question. Regarding your global value strategy, have you ever tested the strategy using relative CAPE ratios versus absolute to determine country allocations in order to avoid countries with structurally low CAPE ratios?
Yeah, this is one of those consistent questions we get on the podcast. I feel like we need to add a section of the website just called FAQs, and we
already talked about that. We need to do it.
And that will be the first section, is that we'll need to talk about a section on the podcast of frequently referenced MEB referencing doing frequently referenced FAQs. Yeah, so this one is I'm agnostic. We looked at it both ways. The problem I have, and Schiller actually does this with sectors, is that it will have a huge bias to bubbles and booms. And so in Japan, you had this massive, the biggest bubble we've ever seen. So if you did relative CAPE, that means Japan is cheap on any CAPE level below 50, because it spent a ton of time in this bubble above 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, and then back down for 20 years. So that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And then if you have a country that is structurally low, let's call it Russia, and something shifts, well, then you would always think anything above 5 is expensive. So I don't like it, one, but it historically hasn't made a whole lot of difference.
Okay. All right, next question. I've never heard of a 401k plan offering ETF options. Is there a reason logistically, legally, et cetera, that prevents 401k plans from offering ETFs? You've discussed a lot about the advantages over mutual funds for long-term savings. So why aren't more available for 401ks?
Let's back up and say that, you know, a lot of people say once ETFs finally get into retirement accounts, that's going to be the death knell for mutual funds. You know, you lose one of the biggest benefits of ETFs in retirement accounts, and that's the tax efficiency. I got into a grumpy tweet storm last night where I said reasons to sell your mutual fund moves to ETFs. One, on average, mutual funds are twice as expensive as ETFs. So the average expense ratio of mutual funds is 1.25% versus 0.51 for ETFs. Two, mutual funds are vastly more tax inefficient. So there's a lot of different studies, but it's approximately extra 0.8% tax drag from owning a mutual fund. So you add those two together and you're up to, you know, 1.5% spread bar that fund needs to outperform just to hit the ETF bogey. That's crazy. And lastly, there's an article that you sent to me in the Financial Times that says most mutual fund managers have nothing invested in their own fund. And I actually said, that's pretty smart. They shouldn't have anything invested in their own fund because it's really stupid because it's expensive and tax inefficient. That all having been said, I actually don't think that 401ks and retirement accounts is like the killer app for ETFs because they lose that tax efficiency. They're still cheaper, but one of the main benefits is gone. So yes, would I rather have ETFs in the, a lot of retirement accounts? Sure. Problem with a lot of the retirement accounts is they can't handle the intraday trading. It's the end of day trading. And so ETFs, unless they bundle the orders or do something, they're not going to be able to the structure of the funds aren't set up to deal with ETFs.
All right. So you would then say then for retirement funds, that strategy potentially trumps cost and expense ratio?
What strategy?
Well, that's the point. A strategy that's going to give you better returns is probably more important to look at.
I think the number one consideration almost always is expense ratio. Like that's the bar. So I think you want as cheap as possible in your retirement account. Half these retirement accounts have absurd management.
Wait, but you're just saying that the cost saving benefits go away in a retirement account.
No, ETF. The tax benefits.
Tax benefits. Okay.
The cost benefits remain.
Excuse me. Yep.
Yeah. And 401ks and a lot of retirement accounts use it as an excuse to just hose you on fees. It sucks. And so I think I would highly encourage people, if you don't know what your retirement plan is charging you, to find out. You will probably be shocked. A lot of times there's crappy fund options as well. So Cambr uses Vanguard just because obviously we love them. But a lot of these companies are predatory. But you can Google. You can, like, if you do 529 plans, Google the best 529 plans per state. You don't even have to use your own states. So there's a lot of ways, if you do a little homework, to hopefully find a better one. But they are historically just burdened with a lot of crazy. And so, for example, I tweeted the other day, there was an article in the Journal, and could have been based on, I don't know, an old article we wrote about how it's crazy. There's all these S&P 500 index funds that still charge 1.5 to 2.2%. And they're literally based on the same exact index that charges three basis points, 0.03%. And so all those people, I said, why in the world would you ever pay? It's literally the exact same thing. And a lot of people emailed into me and they said, Meb, actually, you know, problem is this is the only option in my 401k is this dog shit stock fund that's S&P 500 that charges 1.5%. So it's, again, the internet shines a lot of light and disinfectant on these areas. So eventually, hopefully they will go away. People hopefully will vote for their dollars, but it is such an awful practice just to fleece people in their retirement accounts because they don't have any choice.
Yeah, it's forcing them into it. All right. Next question is actually, we're going to combine two because it's pretty much the same thing. First one starts off, I like your shareholder yield strategy. But if I get capital return through buybacks and share appreciation, how do I get monthly income without selling shares and triggering taxes? Do I just leave enough cash in my account to pull from each month or use bond ladders? I don't see how I can implement a monthly income plan with this strategy.
I mean, if you need...
Second question was, it was kind of winding a little bit. So it really reduces to, how do I structure my portfolio for a 4% yield after tax? Both looking for income.
I have a hard time with the A and B questions because I have a hard enough time answering one question alone without getting off track. So we'll try. I mean, here's the thing I've never really understood about the income set is, let's say you need 5% income this year. Well, invest 95% of your money, leave 5% in a high yielding, as we talked about earlier, money market account that's going to get you 2%, and just spend that over the course of the year and be done with it. Like, why do people have to max it out 100% on the investment and look for some sort of yield? Like, it's the craziest thing. I mean, they have these managed payout funds, so that you can buy a fund that's managed payout that every quarter will hit 4%. But half the time, those guys have to do capital return as well. So if you invest in a portfolio that only has a 2% yield, what those funds will do is they will give you a 2% yield and then they'll return 2% of your capital. Yeah, so it's crazy.
Like an annuity almost.
Right. But you're going to be paying tax. Like, it's, they have to then sell it and you pay taxes. So you have a couple options. One is you create a synthetic, but it's not like dividends magically. Let's say the question is reframed. Let's say, hey, Meb, I want an 8% yield. I need 8% income per, let's make it simpler. I need 10% income per year. Well, you're going to say, that's crazy. Where are you going to get 10% income? So what are you going to do? You can either max it out and sell some down each month or quarter as you need the checks, but that's totally unrelated to what your actual income is.
I think the assumption all these people are asking really is they want their cake and they're going to have it too, where basically I want to invest 100% of my investable funds and from that, give me my 4%. From that, give me, they don't want the sort of 90% let it ride,
just
10%.
Put the amount of income you want in cash and invest the rest so that you achieve the ultimate total return. We showed the mistake of this in our white papers. We said, if you're focusing on dividend yields, in many cases, particularly right now, you have a much more suboptimal approach that despite the fact you have a higher yield, you're going to have a lower total return. So you're penny smart, pound foolish. So if it was me, I would leave 5%. I'd say we want a 5% yield. I'd leave 5% of my checking account, optimize it so that it's getting 2% a year at Goldman or Ally. How do you say it? Ally.
Ally Bank,
maximyinterest.com. I'd use one of those services to max out my cash interest. So it's getting 2%. So it sits in there. And then the next year I do the same thing. That way you don't have any capital gains or you're not even paying any dividend taxes.
I think theoretically some people would be saying, well, I don't have enough capital base for that percentage to give me what I need.
No, it's because most people magically equate getting a dividend check with getting a check from their company. And it's not the same thing. Company that's sending you a dividend is just returning some of your cash the same way they do if they buy back shares. They're not magically sending you earnings on the top of your stock certificate. It's not the way that it works.
All right. Let's see here. Last question. Can you explain step-by-step the process of conducting a back test? I want to know what you're doing once you get the data so I can explore my own trading ideas.
Jeff's getting a little sleepy over here. I think it's because his blood sugar is getting low because he didn't have any green Kit Kats. So backtest, I mean, this is pretty basic stuff. You come up with an idea, a theory, a hypothesis, this is a scientific method. You test it. You know, where people get into trouble, of course, is the idea itself is flawed or silly. We said, hey, there's many people, these academics that have come up with backtests where they just buy all stocks, start with the letter Q, or they look at all 26 variables and some of them are going to vastly outperform because of randomness. But if you do 26 tests, you're going to end up with one letter that's the best.
Are you using just Excel to run a lot of your stuff? Or like
No, I've used like dozens of different programs. Some built in-house, some are custom, some we've purchased, some are off the shelf. It's everything. It's highly
that might be kind of what he's asking is like some more rubber meets the road. Like, how does it actually work? What do you do?
Well, he said process. So we've done a post on the blog many times called Free Data Sources. It's also under the timing model where there's a lot of websites now that track our and other models. Allocate Smartly is one, Extra Genic or Extra something, Extra Dash is another one, ETF Replay. There's a bunch of these sites that will track models. We give away a free back tester with our Idea Farm subscriptions as well that you can play around with and understand how a lot of these back tests work. But again, it all goes back to, is this a sensible premise? You know, we talk about indexing with our cheeseburger idea. Like, do CEOs eat cheeseburgers or hamburgers? It's a very recent example because In-N-Out truck was here at our office yesterday. which is awesome because we have a vegan, a vegetarian, and someone who doesn't eat bread in the office. So we had a lot of extra tickets. So I had two In-N-Out burgers yesterday. It was lights out after that.
How was your nap?
Oh, I wish. So yeah, I mean, look, the biggest problem for a lot of people too is coming up with data. Certainly if you have a local business school, you can go hit them up for some free data resources. There's a lot on our blog. We said free data sources. There's French Fama. There's a million others. We can download many years of databases and play around.
All right. That's it for Q&A. That's it for tweets. Anything top of mind you want to talk about before we close out?
That's it, man. Hit me up if you're in Colorado, San Antonio, Nashville, Vegas. Is Nashville actually called Nashville? Isn't Nashville called Nash Vegas?
Nash Vegas. Okay.
So Nash Vegas and Vegas. Rhode Island. Anywhere else you guys want
Road Vegas.
The Meb and Jeff Show to come to your local town, shoot us an email at feedback@themebfavor.show.com and give us an excuse to come to your town. We'd love to come visit, give a speech, hang out, have a beer, have a whiskey highball. That's my new drink of the summer.
Whiskey highballs?
Yeah.
It's got to go.
It's big in Japan.
It's got to go whiskey, man.
No.
Whiskey neat. No. Temperature.
Because it has the benefit of being hydrating you with the water. It's a lot of soda water. And a little bit of whiskey. It's lower alcohol content.
As you eat your Kit Kats?
As you eat my Kit Kats. Have my Kit Kat and eat them too. Thanks for listening, friends. It's been a great podcast. As always, you can find the show notes at mebfavor.com/podcast. Pick up a new copy of the book. Let us know what you think. Leave a review. Ditto for the podcast. Thanks for listening, friends. Have a great summer. Good investing.